You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
On Brand is brought to you by the Brand Driven Digital Event Series, featuring the Social Brand Forum. This industry-leading digital marketing event brings the best and brightest thought leaders to the heart of the heartland for 2 days of insightful keynotes and interactive discussions. Learn more and register now at socialbrandforum.com.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? Today's guest is Mitch Joel. Mitch is president of Twist Image, one of the largest independent digital marketing agencies in North America. Marketing Magazine dubbed him the rock star of digital marketing and called him one of North America's leading digital visionaries. Mitch is the past chairman of the board of directors of the Canadian Marketing Association and a former board member of the Interactive Advertising Bureau of Canada. Mitch speaks frequently to diverse groups like Walmart, Starbucks, Nestle, Procter & Gamble, Unilever, and has shared the stage with former President of the United States Bill Clinton, Sir Richard Branson, Malcolm Gladwell, Anthony Robbins, Tom Peters, and Dr. Phil. Mitch is a regular columnist for the Harvard Business Review, the Huffington Post, and other magazines and newspapers. His first book, Six Pixels of Separation, named after his successful blog and podcast, is a business and marketing bestseller. His latest book, Control-Alt-Delete, was released in May 2013. Mitch, welcome to On Brand.
Nick, it is an honor to be with you.
You know, I always say start with something fun, but your bio references you being the rock star of digital marketing, which I would have to agree with. But you have something of a rock and roll past, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, not only do I have a rock and roll past, as of this moment, I'm going to have a rock and roll present as well. But yeah, no, I started my career out actually as a young teenager, writing for rock publications and pop magazine. And my first actual job was actually interviewing Tommy Lee from Motley Crue. It's pretty crazy. Obviously, it's downhill after that. And I wound up publishing music magazines. I wound up putting these magazines very early days on the internet. I mean, this is before hyperlinks existed. Some people who have done deep searches claim that I may have one of the first music publications ever on the internet, which I don't know if I could agree or disagree with. I really don't know. And then I had a record label actually around the same time that I started Twist Image with my business partners. And I just sort of decided to go in the Twist Image route. Why I say I might have a present as well is yesterday I launched a new podcast. And it's called Groove, the No Treble podcast. No Treble is the largest online destination for bass players. I'm actually a bass player. I wouldn't even call myself a bass player. I know how to play bass, but I have a love of the instrument. And what we decided to do is to take what I do with the Six Pixels of Separation podcast and just literally replicate it, but with bass players. I think it is a grossly underserved instrument, and I think a lot of these guys are amazing artists and creative types, and most of the content around them filters around the gear, licks, techniques, how to survive on the road, the studios and stuff like that. And I wanted to not do any of that. I just wanted to have conversations about being a musician and being a creative person and the sort of desires there. The first episode went live, and much in the same vein as it's all downhill after the Tommy Lee thing, my first conversation is with Robert Trujillo, who is the bass player of Metallica. So, yeah, it's like, what do you do after that? And it was an hour long, and it's up on the internet, and I'm actually literally blogging about it now on my blog to let people know that it exists, and I'm really proud of it. It's going to come out probably monthly, maybe bi-monthly to start with, but it's really sort of scratching an itch that I had to try this format in another genre.
So you talk about the format of taking it and and dropping it over here. And one of my favorite things about how you just get started with what you do would be your, who are you and what do you do way that you kick off your podcast. But for this, is that different at all because they all play bass?
No, I did it. I did. I'm doing it. It's my, yeah, I did it. And it's funny to hear what people say when, someone like Robert is overly famous. I don't even know if you could even just claim famous. I think Metallica can basically sell out any place that has electricity. I do ask it because I think it's good to sort of hear how people introduce themselves. It's an interesting thing.
It is. Well, I never thought about it from that perspective, as opposed to, running down the bio that I kind of put together based on, the content that, the guest has put online or that you've pieced together from various bios. Because it is interesting to hear someone from their own personal brand perspective, how they describe themselves.
Yeah. And, I didn't expect him to say, I'm Robert Trujillo and I'm the bassist for Metallica. I expected him to say, something else. And even like, I love Seth Godin, as everybody knows. I'm probably his number one. I'm like the president of the fan club. And when I ask him, he's been on my show a million times. He'll always say something like, I notice things. That's what I do. I notice things. So I like that. I think it's interesting.
So flipping that back on you, then how would you introduce yourself? What do you do?
It depends on the context, and it depends on what I'm doing. Primarily, I am the president of Twist Image, which is a digital marketing agency that was most recently acquired by WPP. I also do consider myself a writer. I love to write. It is as much a part of me as my limbs are. And I like to connect. I mean, I really do. I like connecting. I like to connect with people. I like to connect brands to people. I like connecting people to people. I like connecting brands to brands. If I do anything, I think it's trying to connect. I like to connect ideas. I don't think I'm an original thinker. I think I'm a connector of disparate ideas.
I like that. I like that.
Well, it's easier than saying I steal. I'm just kidding.
I'm a thief.
Well, I mean, it's Austin Kleon, right? Steal like an artist. I think there's a lot to be said about having enough inputs. I call myself an infovore. Having enough inputs where ideas are sparking and ideas are flying. I carry around a notebook. I have my iPhone. I'm constantly, I got to remember that. What about this? Oh, I saw that thing over there. How did that connect to that? I can't believe. And those sorts of things, really go. I mean, I'm working on my next interview for Groove, that the music podcast. And I just sort of really quickly read a bio or a couple of articles about the person to catch myself up. And then I just sort of let it, it's like basting. The longer you let something baste, the more moist and tender it is after you cook it. I think that ideas are the same way. And you got to have a lot of things sort of going in. You got a lot of ingredients in that, in the sauce, to get the marinade going. And so I really do think, to a certain degree, it's not like I woke up and said, hey, podcasting is a very serious deal now after Serial. I look at Serial and I think about podcasting. I think about the meteor quests for the golden age of podcasting. And then I start wondering if we're entering into a new era of how people consume audio. And so I don't think that that's an original idea, but I think that even just saying that out loud, I can feel the sediments of a blog post coming on, or an idea, or maybe a Harvard Business Review article, or a book. Who knows?
You talk about podcasting, obviously getting its somewhat serial-driven, day in the sun here. And you talk about, how long have you been doing Six Pixels?
The blog or the podcast?
The podcast side of it, I was just thinking.
Yeah. I'm going to do what everyone should do, just look on Google here. 2006. 2006, every week without fail. Since 2006.
I was going to say, because it was one of the first digital marketing podcasts that I found. So I thought it had to be. And then, you're interviewing there and, you're starting this new interview-driven podcast. I was curious, though, me being into my second podcast and trying to do some things the same, some things differently. You talked about, connecting ideas and on the phone and so forth. How do you approach, you kind of flip it around on, the interviewee to introduce themselves, but what's your approach to research, to learning about something?
I don't. And it surprises a lot of people to hear that. And the reason I don't research is because I only choose guests that I know or I've been exposed to or that I read something about or I read their books or I read an article. And then I initiate a conversation about whether or not there'd be any level of interest to have them on the show. And I do. I carry around the list with me of people who haven't been on the show yet who I'd like on the show. And I don't do any research, really. Maybe 5 or 10 minutes before I sit down to have a conversation, I might take some notes. None of them are questions. They're not in any sort of form of chronological order. And all of this is exactly a part of the process of producing the show. I don't want to do radio on the internet. Hey, everybody, welcome to blah, blah, blah. And right after the break, we're going to talk to, I look at audio and digital formats and podcasting as a way to experiment. And if you go back to the earlier episodes of my podcast, and please don't, they're not interview format. They're not conversation format. They're just me rambling. And I just caught myself when I said interview. It's not an interview, my show. It's a conversation. And so it would be like me saying, hey, Nick, want to grab a coffee? And you go, sure. And then you spend 6 weeks researching me. We wouldn't do that. You'd show up for coffee and you'd be, so who are you and what do you do? And we'd have a conversation. And I keep the rails very loose on it because I did spend close to 15 years interviewing the most famous of famous musicians and artists, thousands of them. So I'm not coming into this cold. I'm not coming into this going, ooh, how do you speak to someone? What do you? So I understand the dynamics of interviews to elicit response that would be quotable and snackable and something for publishing. I also think that because of what I do, I have an interest in communications, talking, writing, listening. So over the years, it's a skill that I keep nurturing, whether it's speaking to my spouse or having a conversation with you when we happen to connect in some random city. Mm-hmm. I worry a lot about I would get nervous having to sit down and interview someone or have a conversation with someone that I didn't really know at all. I would be nervous.
You talk about having conversations and not doing some of that research, and that reminds me of because I did in reapproaching this podcast. I thought, okay, I'm gonna do some reading on interviewers I respect, and the one in the podcasting vein that you're. Overview sounds the most like is Mark Maron, who you are one of my favorite marketing podcasters. He is one of my favorite non-marketing podcasters, and my universe almost collapsed upon itself when you had him on your podcast. I think it was a year ago,
about a year ago.
Yeah. So what was that like? Just speaking with another podcasting giant.
Yeah, it was weird. It was weird because the backstory to this is one of my closest friends is this guy Andy Nolman, who is the founder of the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival, which is a globally recognized festival. It's where people like Jerry Seinfeld and Howie Mandel were first discovered. It's been going on forever. We actually wound up building their website and doing work for them, but beyond that, he and I are friends. And every year, as the festival sort of went on and on, you keep trying to bring in more interesting things. So they started bringing in people like Chris Hardwick and, just really sort of like more, I would call them more YouTube-y, internet-y type folks. And I reached out to him and just said, no, I said, listen, I understand when they come to the city, it's crazy. They're doing local media, international media. It's insane. My podcast is ridiculous because it's 45 minutes. So it's not like you're just shuffling me through the 15 minute where the guy sits at the same chair, but if he has an interest at all in doing something like this, I don't want to interview him about his comedy. I want to interview him about the dynamics of the show and what he like the back, the sausage factory. Mm-hmm. I don't talk about the sausage or the hot dogs. And it came back. Yeah. And Chris Hardwick came back as, yeah, there were a couple over the years that have come back as, yeah, and that I've done. Why I say it was funny is because I went there and it actually was, I was part of the caravan. So it's like, they're like, okay, wait. Like, and they gave me the 45 minutes to an hour, but I was just part of the caravan. So he's like sitting at this thing with like, you know, the backdrop from some, from, I think that was probably a comedy festival. And, you know, here's the local TV crew. Here's this, here's that. And I sit down and I, you know, break out my iPod and I've got my little iRig. And he's like, you know, what are you doing? I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, you're going to record with that? I'm like, yeah. He's like, you know, you got to like, you know, bring a rig and like two mics and this and that. I said, you know, I don't know. I get what you're saying. I just, I'm not that tech. It's easy. We're talking, whatever. We start recording the show. And I think it took him like 5 or 10 minutes before it clicked and he realized like this wasn't like about his comedy. And it wound up being, I thought it was a really fun conversation. I learned a lot because I'm such a huge fan of what he does too. I mean, he gets everybody and anybody he wants on his show, and it really is more entertainment based too. And that's the, I think that like, even when I do conversations with people like Seth Godin, I don't like talking necessarily about the content of his latest book. I like talking about like, what's your day like? It's so interesting. Like, what does he do? What does Seth Godin eat? How does he go to work? Where does he go to work? Why? What is his office? You know, like those are the things that I'm just so nerdily curious about.
Well, I forget if it was Marin or Hardwick or one of them, because I mean that's the other thing I'm a fan of. That's why I like your show and Marin's and Nerdist is I like, you know, long form conversations, and I think it was Hardwick that talked about when you have someone on for that long, kind of to your last point about, you know, learning more about than just kind of the sales pitch for the latest book or whatever. But when you talk with someone that long, you kind of break down some of the usual walls that we have up.
I don't disagree with that. I think that if you have chemistry and like people always say, like, how long should a pod? I just had this fight on Facebook, you know. Who is a wit too? It was someone who I really like. And I was like, oh, how long, you know, no podcast should be more than 15 minutes. Blah, blah. I think a conversation should be as long as a conversation needs to be. I do think that it takes a while to get energy and flow, but I do believe that there are what I would call fundamental techniques to elicit great conversation that a lot of people don't know and don't follow. So I also think it's a bit of trickery because I am doing things in the conversation to elicit more depth. And so I'm not trying to make it sound like, oh, I'm so smart. It's not about that. It's just, again, over the years and the techniques I've learned, I do my best to really elicit things from them that you don't hear. I mean, listen, I would be one of those guys shuffled in every 15 minutes with the guys from Motley Crue or Metallica. And it would be like, you have 15 minutes and this, people come and go, so tell me about the new album. Tell me about why you produced it. Tell me where you recorded. Tell me what the tour is going to be like. Tell me what's your favorite song. I could go through the list, right? It's like so boring. And I would walk in there and say something like, you know, they liked football. And I'd say something like, can you believe the Cowboys, you know, won? Well, I know nothing about football, but whatever. And it would just elicit, they would immediately switch into a different groove because it wasn't the same thing they just answered 50 times. So it's like breaking the monotony. And I like that style. I think I use that style constantly. And I also think that it's fair to be challenging, which I think scares a lot of people. If you write a book and you say this, you better be ready to defend it. And just as I would be, I want you to be as well. And I know that a lot of times people listen to my show and wince in the conversations I'm having. And I know a lot of times when I'm done recording, I'll hear the person say things like, was that okay? Because they're somewhat worried. And I always say the same thing, which is I'm okay if you're okay. And I believe that if you created something and you can all speak to it really cogently, that's great. I believe if you can't speak to it or you can't defend your ideas, you're going to start running into corners, and it's not my fault, it's you. So when people come off as bad or not being sensical, and I'm as guilty of that in instances as well, it's not because I'm being a dick, right? It's because they're not able to cogently defend their stance. That's it.
In thinking about all of that, I mean, I mean, it sounds so simple, and yet I think it's easy to kind of come in with that barrage of, you know, the same old, like you said, to treat podcasting, even in what we're doing, you know, I think there's so many connections, which I think you probably find all the time, with your music background, because it is, it's a danger in making all of this like the junket guys.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's worse than that, because at least when it's the junket guys, if entertainment is fun, yeah. Business is tough.
I was going to say their content's at least usually more appealing than a lot of times what we're talking about.
Oh yeah, done right. No, totally. I'm trying to think. I had a conversation the other day with someone for a podcast. Oh, it was with Nir Eyal from Hooked. Great book. And he has these sort of four things. That is sort of his four-thing system. And we were laughing after, because I said, you know, control, delete, I talk about the five movements that change brands are. And I said, the worst question, it's the question you always get, is tell me about the five movements. So I just wrote a 300-page book about it. You want me to break it down? And I feel like you're screaming that. And it's that junket laziness. And what happens is, as the person being asked that, you are immediately bored with it, because you're like, oh, how am I going to do this? And somebody listening might say, well, as a communications expert and media trainer, you got to get in there 15 seconds. I know. But I am trying to have a conversation here. And I think that that's a bad way to elicit a conversation. What you could say is, Mitch, one of the movements is called sex with data, and in that you say this. Tell me why. Okay, let's have a conversation, you know? But it's so brutal to listen. I mean, I really have a hard time listening to most podcasts, because it's not the person they're speaking to. It's how they're conducting the conversation. And I can read an FAQ. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think that there's it's something that's missed by so many in terms of what the kind of the art and science of talking to someone, how that works. And I was just like you said, I send over an FAQ and they'll just answer that and post it somewhere. If it's just kind of reading through the questions that are, you know, on some sort of arbitrary lineup.
Yeah. It's like when you read a review on Amazon and the person basically writes out all their notes from the book. And they give it like a 5 or a 3, and I'm like, that's not a review. You know, that's not a review. In fact, I don't need to read the book now. I mean, it's silly to say that, but when I see that stuff, I'm always like, why would do that? Like, I think I miss, you know, I really do. I love social media. I love connecting. It is what I do, but I miss mystery. I miss mystery. I miss not knowing why someone wrote that lyric. I miss not knowing why that person won't do any interviews. I miss sort of my interpretation of it, even though it may or may not be accurate. Like, that's what I loved so much about the music industry. And it's actually one of the components that I really loved about the world without social media. It was sort of like the quiet space, right? The space where you don't hear from this person. Yeah. And the middle ground of that, I think Seth Godin is the perfect example, and it brews up like a bad case of a venereal disease. But people will inevitably say, like, oh, Seth isn't a real blog because he doesn't accept comments, and that concept's dying more and more now as social changes and becomes so fragmented. But I would always be like, my response to that was always, shut up, because if you make him mad or you stress the guy out, he'll stop blogging. And the problem with that is, unlike music, which bands tour and then do an album and tour, book writing has gaps of a year or two. Before Seth Godin blogged, I would wait 2 years for a book. Otherwise, I heard nothing from him. There was no Twitter. There was no Facebook. And that gap to me was too long. It was too hard for me. I mean, it made me very, very hungry for more content and much more excited. But I love the fact that every day there's a little piece of candy from Seth on his blog, and other people too. I'm just using Seth as a sort of catch-all for the people who do that. So you've got the mystery of the music industry. You've got the ability now to tell these stories in these more direct ways. I like that. I just don't like too much of it, because I think that the mystery is still important. Like, I love the fact that Seth doesn't tweet, you know? I guess enough, you know, and I mean that in a good way.
And on the last podcast that I had, the Work Talk Show, when we had him on, it was interesting hearing him talk about that, not just from, you know, kind of a marketing decision point angle, but from a time management and how he allocates time to what he does. And, you know, his take, and, you know, you being... and me and many being, you know, members of his community, the, you know, the customers that he serves. And he, you know, talked about, you know, am I going to, you know, kind of monkey around on Twitter, or am I going to write these you know, these snacks. And he said, my time, you know, with the volume of comments or, you know, at mentions or whatever he'd get, you know, if he opened up comments or was engaging via social media, that it would take away those snacks that we're getting otherwise. So I think that that's, you know, actually an amazing finger that he's got kind of on the pulse of who he's talking to.
Yeah, and I think that I think he's a great example of someone who almost is like that throwback to the musicians, where he does still have a lot of mystery about him. You see his content, but it's very focused. He doesn't really talk about his personal life. He doesn't really talk about his process in terms of what it probably really is. And I just always feel that there's this aura about him. You know, Gladwell does it exceedingly well. Clay Shirky does that exceedingly well. And when I'm even marketing myself, I always call it that type. I always look at that filter and I look at things and go, would so-and-so do that? Would so-and-so go on Twitter and go, hey, follow me, or hey. And then I try and realize, okay, well, they're already famous and they already have lots of followers. Is there a way for me to replicate it in a way that makes me comfortable? I love that. I love thinking about it. Anyways, that's why, again, I would always say I'm not good at Twitter. It's not because I'm, you know, trying to be mysterious or whatever. I'm challenged with that sort of public display of affection. It's not who I am. Thanks, buddy, and I love you, man. And I want to thank people. I'm so grateful that people love my content. I just find it strange. Another way to say it.
Well, yeah, we've lost the mystery, and it seems like we've gained all of this kind of bullish black and white on what everyone should and shouldn't be doing, and that Mitch should be much better at Twitter and all of this stuff.
I do try.
this is the Twitter Therapy Podcast.
Yeah.
We're sitting here in a new year, and you're one of I don't know how you feel about the term, but it seems like one that's applicable here, but about being a futurist. And I think you're a pretty good one, because it is, you know, it's not, you know, flying cars and craziness. It's pretty practical things based on customer experience. And as we're sitting here going into another new year, what should be on brands' radars?
I actually just published about 1,000 words on this, and it's I don't even know if I crystallized it properly, to be honest. I love my blog, so I can always publish it and go, ugh. You know, it's a book you can't do that, you really got to, you know, but I can write a blog post and go, I'm just not sure. You know, one is, I don't consider myself a futurist. I always tell people that I'm a presentist, and I say that because I never could have believed YouTube is what it is. I saw YouTube and thought, well, look at this, a 3x3 screen with buffering issues in a world where you can get a flat screen for like $600. It just made no sense to me. Twitter, same. I mean, I could go on. I learned to love them. I learned to understand them. So what I think is most profound is that, well, it's sort of two things. One is, I feel that brands are being very much distracted. They're being distracted by things like big data, marketing automation. They're being distracted by things like 3D printing and the Internet of Things and drones and all that sort of stuff. All of those are interesting. All of those are things we need to think and look at. But we have something bigger that's right in front of us that is more, I would say, concerning to being a marketing professional. And what that is that we have what I believe is the first time in history that the consumer actually is changing. I think people would have said through consumer reviews and through the internet, social media, that the consumer has changed. They can shop a brand 24 hours because of e-commerce. They can connect, blah, blah, blah. I'm not sure if that's true. I think that it's different. I think the way in which brands get attention is different, but the model was still create attention, create conversion. So the other parts of it were just mechanical and dynamic, fine. Did it change the actual consumer? Maybe a little bit. I'm sort of on the fence, because I would have said yes a month ago, you know. Now what I think is the challenge is that they're doing two things, consumers. One is, they are no longer owning a lot of things. And the best example we could look at is music, again, something I know. We went from vinyl and cassettes to CDs in a short period of time, but many years. We went from CDs to digital downloads a lot quicker. We are currently going from downloading to streaming in the blink of an eye. you can look at that and go, okay, so the cloud, big deal. I think it is a big deal. I think when a consumer decides that they're going to spend $7 a month to access an entire library of content that they don't quote unquote own, versus a world where they would sort of download a music, like literally they've decided that even downloading a song or an album, it's like a waste of hard drive space, and it's so limiting in a world where I could basically have access to the catalog. So that's the first thing, is suddenly consumers have gone from ownership to access. That's tremendously profound. The second massive shift is that if you look at the world of what my friend Jeremiah Aoyang would call, you know, the collaborative economy, these crowd companies, this the Uberization of everything, suddenly what we see is a world where what you do own, you can now sell or share when you're not using it. Airbnb, and we could go on and on. So what's happening in that bucket is now it's not about just owning, it's about earning money and sharing it. What that does, if you combine those two thoughts, is you have a very different consumer because they've become more efficient. They're owning less because they're streaming more, which is a different model. If they do own something, they're trying to share it or leverage technology to sell it when it's in its downtime or to make money on it. Now, if we don't stop as a marketing business and go 1 second, this is going to change literally how people buy and what they need to buy and how much they buy. This is going to have huge ramifications on the global economy, right? We're seeing it right now in business, by the way, Uber, Facebook, all these companies, they're making billions of dollars and worth billions of dollars, and they have a fraction of the people working there that we would have had in business 10 years ago. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm ambivalent to it, but it's a reality. Consumers are getting more efficient with their stuff. They may decide, you know, I don't need so much anymore. We're seeing this trend with small houses and stuff like that. So I'm being very long-winded because it's a more robust thought, but I don't believe marketers are solving for that problem. Are they creating digital products and services to match the sort of streaming model? Are they actually initiating some sort of life cycle around product development that would satiate the fact that they're going to want to maybe take whatever they buy and sell it, reuse it, share it? Those are huge ramifications on us. And again, we're worried about drones and 3D printing.
So, I mean, if there was one way for a marketer to grab on to some of that, I mean, to start one thing, you know, what would you recommend?
I think it's to look at what, you know, marketing is the product, price, promotion, place. People hate when I say it's the four P's. It's like, it's so old. Like, we don't, the four P's are dead. Oh, okay. Well, product, price, promotion, place sounds pretty relevant to me. Because all that can be digital. It could be ephemeral, right? It doesn't have to be physical. So I think the best place to start is to relook at that model in the digital world. And what I'm saying is, can you as a business, B2B or B2C, develop digitally based products and services that you can now sell that aren't just engines of advertising, but they're actually engines of business? Example might be, instead of doing an app that's like a promotion for an upcoming thing, why not build an app that's actually a product or service that your customers would need, want, and love? We can all do this now, and that's the profound learning, right? Text, images, audio, video, multimedia. Any brand or business can take this idea and build something. They don't just have to look at all of these channels and advertise. This is, you know, my book, I called it, you know, utilitarianism marketing. Jay Baer was a lot smarter than me and called it utility with a Y. And he wrote a whole book about it. It was one of my five movements. He wrote the whole book. And it's a very similar train of thought. And I think we're on that same path because it's something. It's there. It's an obvious thing for businesses to do. And I think that that's where I would start.
And how does that, I mean, one more question in there as a kind of pivot on that. From the agency perspective, how does that impact, I mean, you obviously being a leader of a huge agency, how's that impact what agencies are doing?
It's funny, you would say huge, I would say small. You know, 100 people, well, I mean, it's 100 people, so it depends on your perspective. It's actually quite small, and in the scope of WPP, it's a toss away, which humbling.
You're part of a big family.
Family. There's no doubt that the family is a gargantuan, huge beast. There's no doubt about that. The people who are my boss are huge. Yeah. I believe that we have been doing it for close to 15 years, which is potentially why we were acquired. We have never been in the business necessarily of strictly advertising and marketing. We have been in the business of transformation. And while that is a very cool word to use these days, the best way I could express it is our excellence here has been in taking brands that are either nascent or non-existent in some of these digital spaces and show them how it can be a powerhouse of business. In doing that work, some of it is campaign-based and some of it is smaller project-based. What it does is it forces the brand to actually look at what the business goals are versus what we're trying to solve in terms of a campaign. It has forced brands to reorg. It has forced brands to restructure it. So the work that we've done has over the years transcended that. And I do believe that, obviously, because we're doing it, that this is the model. And if I look to the real leaders, the people who are, you know, 10, 15, 20 times our size, that is the direction that they're sort of positioning themselves as. It's almost like strategy has now become the tip of the spear, which is something we've been doing for a long time. And then once we know the why, we can start doing the hows and the whats. And for me, I think that the runway for agencies who can help brands constantly do these things is very long and wide. I'm hopeful. I'm gambling on it, of course. This is my career, so I'm hoping that I'm right. There are forces at play that might prove me wrong, and I'm aware of them and nervous about it, obviously. But I do believe that that is the role of an agency. An agency is there to act as an agent on behalf of the brand as their partner. Primarily, that was done through advertising before. I think it needs to transcend that. I have to be very careful what I say, but I am skeptical of the integrated model. I'm skeptical of an agency that says we can do everything. If I blew my knee out today, I would not go see a GP. I would go see a knee specialist.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of where I live and breathe. And I think it focuses us, and it should focus any other agency, on really defining who your best type of customer is.
So in thinking about all of this, as we wrap up, what's a brand that's made you smile lately? Maybe someone that gets all of this.
Yeah, it's funny. I would say that the brand that I'm going to choose is probably the antithesis of everything we discussed today, which I think speaks to the volumes of what the world is. The brand that I'm sort of been very fascinated with lately is Field Notes. I don't know if you're familiar with Field Notes.
I carry them in my pocket.
Me too. It's in my back pocket and it's rubbing away right now. It's so silly. It's a simple little notebook, and I don't really necessarily – I wouldn't even say that it's better than a Moleskine, and I love Moleskine. It's another great company. I would say watch them too. But there's something about the sort of rawness of Field Notes, this sort of indie brand feel. There's something about Aaron, one of the guys, there's a great designer, and the way he thinks and acts, that it's inspiring. And for me, it's a brand that really has built itself through – well, I think it has built itself through a lot of the things we've spoken about, but in a more simplistic way. You know, a very simple product, very, very reasonably priced, obviously very, very useful in a digital world. And just the story and everything behind it is, it's inspiring. And it's so silly to say, but when I pull that little notebook out and I look at my notes and my little ideas, I love it because I feel like if it went in the garbage, it wouldn't really bother me, you know? But I want to just make sure there's always a one there. And I don't, for me, it sort of just got me out of the mindset of like, I have my Moleskine book, and where's my Moleskine book? It just got me totally out of that. And like I said, I love the way that they're playing in the space.
Well, it makes me think of Mark Maron and the Moleskine, who says he couldn't write in it. It was almost so nice.
Do you have that stress? I have that
I do. I got a real nice one that someone gave me for Christmas, just sitting on my desk. I'm like, I can't. I have to put something really good in there.
Yeah, no, I literally, this is funny, we're having this conversation. I literally had in my bag my older Moleskine, which is sort of like, like the smallisher one. And I decided I'm going to have like the 8.5 by 11 thinner one, but like at least this will like be more of a notebook. I'm also a lefty. And I've literally been carrying both in my bag for months because I'm like, when I get on a plane or in a hotel, I'll just sort of transfer the bigger ideas over so it's there. And it's same thing. I look at this big book and I'm like, it's too much. It's just too much. And that's part of the reasons I think why I'm even more in love with Field Notes. It's like, if I it's fine. Just Scrabble. The pages don't matter. But yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that. I never thought of it that way, but I guess I have notebook stress.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Mitch, where can folks go to learn more about who you are and what you do?
I guess the blog is always the best place. That would be twistimage.com/blog. And if you can't think or remember that, just Google Mitch Joel. I'm typically Mitch Joel in every space, and happy to connect. I always like to speak to people and see what's going on.
Awesome. Well, Mitch, thank you for being on brand with us.
Thanks, Nick. I appreciate the invite.
A few final reminders. A big thanks to a mentor of this podcast with a resource that you should know more about. Jay Baer of Convince and Convert has done it again. In addition to being a digital marketing thought leader, speaker, and best-selling author, he's now created a new online resource indexing all of the great marketing podcasts out there. It's called, wait for it, Marketing Podcasts, and you can find it at marketingpodcasts.com. If you like marketing and podcasts, you need to check this out. Last but not least, you can find links to everything that Mitch and I talked about on the show at branddrivendigital.com. There's also information for how you can subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher, and RSS. Speaking of iTunes, it's a great reminder that if you like what you're hearing, hop over, give us a quick rating or review, click that star button to rate the show, and drop in a couple of sentences. Let us know what you think of the show. Don't forget that this podcast is brought to you by our Brand Driven Digital event series. To learn more about Twitter Brand Basics, Digital Strategy Bootcamp, and of course, the industry-leading Social Brand Forum, you can check out branddrivendigital.com for information about all of this. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.